So we'll look at conditions in the gastrointestinal system. These are GI conditions, ranging from diarrhea to other serious GI conditions. These conditions under here will begin with diarrhea. Diarrhea could be a symptom for other conditions, and then we have diarrhea conditions that need treatment by itself. Among these conditions, there are so many causative agents that could cause us to have diarrhea, ranging from bacteria to other fungus or other viral infection. We can have diarrhea from those conditions. And diarrhea can be mild or severe. It could be acute or chronic, depending on the causative agent, depending on the signs and symptoms, depending on how well we want to manage it. Acute diarrhea, any word that has acute to it, it means it has a sudden onset, it has an abrupt onset. So we need to put in more nursing management, acute nursing management, to be able to respond rapidly to that acute condition. Sometimes when there is diarrhea condition, it could be secondary to other infection that affect the GI tract, the respiratory tracts, and other part of the body. So sometimes it does not have to be a direct condition that can cause us to have diarrhea, but it could be from other conditions. Like, take for example, like a medication. When we take some medication, most of the antibiotics, we are prone to having a side effect as diarrhea. You're gonna have like a mild diarrhea. Now, those diarrhea do not require treatment. Treatment is only required if the symptom persists and then it becomes more consistent, wherein our fluid electrolytes storages are being tampered with, then that means it requires some form of treatment. Once it's linked with these medications, it does not require treatment. There are other parasitic organisms that are not bacteria, that are not viral, that can also cause bacteria or that can also cause diarrhea infection. Now, the acute one, like I said, it comes in very few days, and it lasts less than 14 days. That become acute. Now, any diarrhea conditions that lasts for more than 14 days is not acute anymore. It is regarded as chronic diarrhea condition. Any condition that lasts for more than 14 days that is causing diarrhea, that becomes a chronic diarrhea infection. Now, this chronic infection could be due to food allergies. They could be due to other mild absorption syndrome. They could be due to IBS, inflammatory bowel disease conditions, or it could be due to other underlying causes that is not identifiable, meaning the etiology is idiopathic, meaning we do not know the cause of the agent for those diarrhea. Now, when there is diarrhea, our major concern, why is that diarrhea is a concern for us in the ankle, is diarrhea itself might not be our major problem, but what comes after the diarrhea is our major problem. That becomes dehydration. Dehydration is our major concern when our patients are at risk for diarrhea condition, because when there is dehydration, there will be decreased fluid, there will be decreased weight, or there will be weight loss. We'll see that. There will be fluid and electrolytes imbalances. Fluid and electrolytes will be imbalanced. We'll see that. Patients are going to have hypotension. They will have hypotension. For the babies, for the infants, they're going to have sunken frontal nail. They're going to have that for the neonates. And then they're going to be very irritable. They will have irritability. They're going to have poor feeding. They will not be eating. They will have poor appetite or poor feedings. These are things that are going to happen. If it persists, then they're going to also have some other ABG problem coming in with this diarrhea. And diarrhea is just a symptom for, dehydration is what's going to come in as a complication for diarrhea condition. So that is where our interest lies when it comes to diarrhea conditions. Now, these conditions, then we tend to like do our assessment. Now, with every condition in the ankles, and I ask you, if a patient is having nosebleed, you arrive at a patient, it's like, what will you do? Now, let's don't forget that in the ankles questions are given in sequence. They are given in the sequence called ADPA. Most of the question, ADPIE. First one is assessment. You do assessment for your patient. The only reason why we do not prioritize assessment ahead of an intervention if our patient is in distress. Now, not all distress. There are certain conditions, certain case scenario, you will look at it and you will know that this patient does not need assessment. Patient will need direct intervention. With that, we go and provide the interventions needed. Now, after assessment, this will take us to diagnosis, or what we call data collections. So we'll have diagnosis under here. We as nurses, we do nursing diagnosis, not medical. So nursing diagnosis has three parts. It has the etiology, it has the disease condition, and it has the manifestation. That's why we always have a three-part nursing diagnosis. Take for example, fluid volume deficit is the etiology. Rigatogiardiasis becomes the condition, and then the signal could be poor skin turgor or other thing that come in. So nursing diagnosis has three parts. It has the etiology, disease condition, and it has the manifestation, which is called the signs and symptoms. Then after that diagnosis, we move to planning. So we provide planning for our patient. If they are having diarrhea, we plan for them. So we do the assessment. They are having diarrhea. I have been diagnosed as diarrhea. Now they are having fluid volume imbalance. Now for fluid volume imbalance, how can we tackle fluid volume imbalance for our patient who's having diarrhea? Then we have to go in and do the planning. This is the planning phase. We go in, get the fluid. Okay, he's having fluid volume imbalance, meaning he has low fluid. We look at the vital signs. He needs fluid. What can we give to the patient? Okay, let's give him lactate ranges, RL, or ranges lactate. We get it. How many ml will he need, or will the patient need? We look at it, we do our calculation. We go in. After the planning, then we do the intervention. They ask him for intervention. Now, at this intervention level, we have to go in and provide or implement what we've planned for, or implement what we brought in after the planning stage. We'll go in, start the IV line, pass medications, make sure he or she is well. That becomes the implementation. Now, the last part becomes the evaluation. Now, at this evaluation, we want to go back and know whether our patient is doing well, whether the patient has a good prognosis, whether our intervention met what the patient needed, to what extent did we meet this patient needs, whether we met the patient needs fully, halfway, or the needs of the patient was not met at all, or were not met at all. These are things we take from the ADPA. So when a patient has any conditions, you kind of look at them in this format. When a patient having nosebleed, when you get there, you want to first of all know what's the cause of the nosebleed. You want to go in, because nosebleed is not an emergency condition. It is not emergency. That's what I'm asking. When a patient has epistasis, it is not emergency. It is not anything like emergency. Yes, they will be panicking. Most of it is their first time experiencing it. They will panic. They will have anxiety, but it is not emergency. So when you get there, you all know, are you on medication? If he's on medication, you know what medication is he on or is she on? It's a blood thinner medication. Because when you're on blood thinner, you're on aspirin, you're on NSAID, those are common things that can cause epistasis. You want to be able to look at that and be able to find out what's happening, what's going on, what happened to you. Now, those are things you're doing. Those things are under assessment. Then when you assess, you know what is the cause of the nosebleed, then you diagnose. Then what can you implement? Maybe the child was in the house was so hot and the heater was on, and then the child started having nosebleed. Because most nosebleed conditions we experience in the US, it is experienced during the winter. Because in winter we stay home and we put the heater up so high, and it ruptures our blood vessels within our nostrils. So that can cause nosebleed. So you want to know the cause of it. Is it maybe did he hit his hair somewhere? These are things you want to check and know. So in diarrhea condition, our concern becomes dehydration. Then we'll go in to know what next to be done. Now, under dehydration, there are a lot of other things that we can see. There will be change in behavior. There will be change in stool pattern, how to defecate. There will be change in there. There will be poor appetite. There will be weight loss. There will be pain occurring. Now, there are some diarrhea causative agents that will cause severe pains. Like when you have giardiasis, you have severe abdominal pain. Like when you have C. difficile. Now, C. diff infection can cause abdominal pain. You have like a cholera disease. Those are things that can cause serious problems. Now, cholera disease is another very huge diarrhea condition that creates so much imbalance between our system. So those are conditions you want to like look at and make sure you are preventing it or their complications. Now, for these conditions, you have the rotavirus can cause diarrhea in children younger than 5 years old. Rotavirus is one of the causative agents. The rotavirus can cause diarrhea in children less than 5 years old. This is very common. For these children, they're going to have fever. They're going to have diarrhea. They will have vomiting for at least about 2 days. Now, this can be transmitted through the fecal oral route. Most of our diarrhea cases, now the 9.9 of our diarrhea cases come through fecal oral route. That's how they come. Now, then we have, when you are infected with the virus, it takes 2 days, which is 48 hours, for you to start to show symptoms. That's the incubation period for a rotavirus infection. Then we have the Yersinia enterocolitis. Another one is the Yersinia enterocolitis. Now, this is another diarrhea infection that also affects a lot of individuals. There's no age specific for this infection. We get it from food and pets. So Yersinia comes from food and pets. That's how we get infected with the diarrhea caused by Yersinia enterocolitis. Then for this infection, they're gonna have abdominal pains. They will have fever. They will have mucoid stool, meaning the stool will be mucus. It will be mucus in its form, and they will have bloody diarrhea. So they're gonna have mucus in the stool, and they're gonna have bloody diarrhea. Now, this is what you want to make sure and mark for this condition. They will have mucus in the stool, and they're gonna have bloody diarrhea occurring. Then we have the E. coli bacterial infection. The E. coli is the Escherichia coli bacterial infection, or called the E. coli for short. Now, this E. coli infection, there is a watery diarrhea, the patient was having watery diarrhea. Let's have that established first. They'll have watery diarrhea. That's the first one. Now, this diarrhea will be accompanied by they will have abdominal cramping and blood in the stool. So they will have watery diarrhea that will come. Then after that, they will have stomach pains. Then they will have blood in the stool. That's what's going to happen to the E. coli infection. Then we This could lead to what we call hemolytic uremic syndrome. This E. coli leads to hemolytic uremic syndrome. Hemolytic uremic syndrome. If it is not stopped, it leads to hemolytic uremic syndrome. Look up for hemolytic uremic syndrome. HEMOLYTIC. Hemolytics. Uremic is UREMIC syndrome. Look out for that. Now, we also have the Salmonella infection. You have the Salmonella non-typhoid group. The one that causes typhoid. Another type is called the Salmonella that does not cause typhoid. It can cause infection. The child going to have severe nausea and vomiting. They're going to have abdominal cramping. They will have fever. They will have bloody diarrhea stool, and they're going to have headache possibly. They might have confusion. They might be drowsy. They can also have seizure, which can lead to meningitis or septicemia. So the Salmonella non-typhoid infection can cause seizure. The child can have other symptoms I'm talking about. They will have confusion. They will have seizure. And then they're going to have septicemia. So you gotta remember that septic conditions have a lot of different complications. So our goal become, how can we stop these conditions from going to complication? That becomes the goal when you are on the unit. Now, this infection, the Salmonella non-typhoid group, can be caused by the transmission is from person to person to person. It's person to person transmission. It can be caused by poultry transmission, like chicken and other things, or it can be caused through uncooked meat. Meat that is not well cooked. You went to buy food from the store or from the restaurant, and you order steak. And the steak is half done half cooked steak. The burger, it might have this bacteria in it. You eat it, it's not have proper. Now that's why in many cases, when we have GI condition, we want to ask the patient, what did you eat lastly? Because huge percentage of the time when we have diarrhea or we have GI conditions, it is due to what we ate. That's why we always ask, what did you eat last day? Where did you eat last day? We want to establish these things and know it from the patient. Then we have the C. diff. Now, C. diff is one of those infections that comes a lot in the ankles. C. diff infection. The C. diff. Now, the C. diff, it is a bacterial infection that the patient will have mild water stool for a few days. They will have water stool for a few days. They're going to have, the symptoms are less severe in children than in adults. So in children, it has less severe symptoms. Less severe symptoms in children than adults. So adults have more severe symptoms. Now, there's a reason why you have to know all these things. Sometimes you might not have this thing coming in English directly. In the ankles, this question could be teaching points. They might ask you, a patient who is having C. diff infection, ask the nurse, why is it that my child had this condition that I have a few years ago or a few months ago? I have more severe symptoms. Why is it my child is not having severe symptoms in this condition? What's the nurse's best response? It says the nurse will say, your child might have a lower dose of the infection. B says your child is having a stronger immunity than you. C says it is normal for children to react to it lesser compared to others. Now you must know the reality of what is happening. And to know this reality for these questions, you have to read this material and know exactly what you are reading. So in C. diff infection, the symptoms are more severe in adults compared to children. They're going to have leukocytosis. they will have hypoalbuminemia. Hypoalbuminemia, albuminemia, low level of albumin within the blood, within the serum. They will have that. Now, they're going to also have high fever in certain children, and they're going to have pseudomembranous colitis. They will have pseudomembranous colitis. So the membrane, the colon will feel like it's inflamed or infected, but it goes away by itself. There is no specified incubation period. The incubation period is 12 to 26 hours. Sorry. So it has an incubation period between 12 to 26 hours. Now, that's why when a patient on a unit has C. diff infection, it is a direct contact infection. So we want to make sure to try to keep other patients away from that infection and make sure and try to like, everything that we use for the patient who is infected cannot be cross-used. Okay, cannot be also used on another patient. The BP cuff, the bare pins, everything that we use for that patient should stay with the patient until the patient can undergo the treatment. Now, then we have the Shigella group. Now, for the Shigella group, which can cause shigellosis, a patient will appear very sick. They will have crampings and other things. Then we have another one we call the Norwalk-like organism. Norwalk, N-O-R-W, is N-O-R-W-A-L-K, Norwalk-like infection. Now, this Norwalk-like infection is also a diarrhea infection. It is also called, the Kalasi viruses. They are called by the Kalasi, C-A-L-I. C-E-V-C-A-L-I-C-E-S-V-I-R-U-S, the Kalasi's viruses. Now, these organisms, they can cause bacteria, they can cause diarrhea infection. It is a viral infection. This Norwalk diarrhea infection is a viral infection. Now, they can cause stomach cramps. It can cause nausea, it can cause vomiting, they will cause weight loss, they can cause diarrhea, malaise that lasts for 2 to 3 days. Now, for this infection, it is most often we get it from water that we drink that is not purified, like a contaminated water. So when the water gets contaminated, we can mostly get it from such kind of water. Then we look at the Enterobius vermicularis. This is a pinworm infection. Enterobius vermicularis is a pinworm infection. It's called the Enterobius vermicularis. Now, the Enterobius vermicularis, it is a pinworm condition. It's called pinworm, P-I-N-W-O-R-M, pinworm infestation. Now, for this infestation, they fall under the worm, or we call it the helminthic infection, helminthic. So, worm infection is called helminthic. Now, this helminthic infection, for this pinworm, it is caused by the Enterobia vermicularis worm or the pinworm. Now, the most common symptom that you're gonna see for these patients will be itching of the anus. They will have perianal itching. So for this Enterobia vermicularis infection, it is caused by this worm, which is also called a pinworm. It causes perianal itching. It causes enuresis, sleeplessness, restlessness due to the itching of the anus area. It causes irritability due to itching also. It is transmitted through the fecal oral route. For this reason, when you ingest anything that contains the ova or the eggs for this infection or for this causative agent. Now, the eggs is laid or hatched in your upper intestine. So that's for example, be like a, someone gave you a piece of bread. The person's hand was in their buttocks, scratching. Or they did not wash their hand, which is very common. Then they grab a piece of food out there. They eat the food and they give you a piece. Oh, let me get a taste of, let me get a bite. Hand it over to another person. That person ate that food. The person will have the infection. Now, the infection does not occur in the small intestines or in the stomach. No. The stomach will digest the food. The remainder of the food will go to the small intestine. From there, it moves to the large intestine. It is in the large intestines that the egg will get hatch. In the upper intestine, the eggs get hatch and mature. So the egg will be hatched and will get mature in the upper intestines. Now, after this period of time, then they will migrate. They will migrate out of the intestine, they will lay eggs. And the egg can survive for 2 to 3 weeks. And that's why herbal will keep infecting other people throughout the last part of this infection. Then we have what we call the giardiasis or giardia lambiasis. Now, for the giardiasis, it is also a parasitic infection. Giardia lamblia is called the giardia, G-I-A-R-D-I-A, giardia L-A-M. It's L-A-M-B-L-I-A, B-L-I-A, giardia lamblia. Now, this is the organism that causes what we call giardiasis. So, giardiasis, it is an infection. It's also a diarrhea infection. Now, this condition, it affects children below 5 years. It can affect any age group, but most of them they affect children in 5 years. The child gonna have diarrhea, they will have vomiting, they will have anorexia, and for older children, they're gonna have abdominal cramps, and they'll have loose, mild odorous greases too. Now, I want you to remember that word, loose, mild odorous greases too. So this giardialambia, the child will have loose, mild odorous greases too, greasy. So the stool they will have will be loose, real diarrhea, mild odorous, foul smelling, and it will appear like an oil. It will appear very oil or greasy in its appearance for the giardiasis condition. It's transmitted through person to person, through food, through animal. For all these conditions, there are specific laboratory tests that we run for these conditions. We run definitely. There are different ones. So for the one that they're gonna have blood stool coming out, we'll do for them hematocrit, hemoglobin, because those will test how many blood they have lost. We'll do the hematocrit, the HCT, or we'll do the hemoglobin, the HGB. We'll do for them the BUN, the serum blood urea nitrogen. For them the CBC, the complete blood count. We'll do for them tests like the creatinine. We'll do the urine specific gravity. We'll do serum creatinine. We'll do the urine specific gravity for the patient. We'll also do for them, stool tests for occult blood. We'll do occult blood tests. We'll do the occult blood test for these patients who having stool to see why there is blood in the stool. Now, when we do the urine test, what are we gonna see? A person who is having dehydration. What could be the result of the urine specific gravity for those patients?
It'll be low.
Why will it be low?
It will be high. Everything will be high. If you're
supposed to
be having dehydration, everything
will
be high.
Okay. So when you are having dehydration, when you are losing fluid, too much fluid from the body, you have increased urine specific gravity. So it's the opposite in terms of the volume. The more fluid we put out of our body, the higher you're going to have the urine specific gravity. So let's remember that very well. Now, then we're going to have, we'll perform urinalysis, and then we'll do other tests. Now, for the case of enterobius vermicularis, what tests can we do for them? When they have the enterobius vermicularis, what tests do we do for them? So these are general tests for all these conditions, but now we have particular tests, we have specific tests for these conditions. One, for the pinworm infection or infestation, which is also called the enterobius vermicularis, we do for them what we call a tip test. The tip test is done for them. The tip test. Now the tip test, it is a test that we tell the parent to place a transparent tip, like a plaster, adhesive tip, let me say it that way, an adhesive tip over the child's anus at night. So we turn the child around, open the buttocks, we use this adhesive tip and cover up their buttocks or their anus at night. The tip is removed in the morning before toileting or before taking a shower. If possible, we have the parent apply the tip after the child has gone to bed and should not remove it until the child wakes up in the morning. So that's how we do the tip test. Now, tell the parents that the specimen should be brought to the laboratory for microscopic evaluation. So you remember we said the pinworm can cause itching in the perianal area. It causes itching, it causes irritability, it causes restlessness. Now, because the itching is caused by the worms that are going to come, the worms' eggs that will be laid in the buttocks area. So when we use the tapeworm, in the morning, the tip is removed from the buttocks or from the anus and sent to the lab for evaluation. That's how the procedure is done. We'll make sure, wash our hands well, wear gloves to do them. So when we do the microscopic examination, we find out there are ova or eggs living on the tip. That is how we know that the child has pinworm. So the tip test can be done for patients who have pinworm, or what we call enterobius vermicularis. So for these conditions, we can give, for the case of C. difficile and Giardia lamblia, for C. diff and giardiasis, C. diff, and giardiasis, we can administer metronidazole is the drug of choice for this condition. Or we can administer another drug in the same category we call tinidazole. So they are the drug of choice for C. diff infection and giardiasis. We can also administer mebendazole, abendazole, and parenteral palmoate. We have parenteral palmoate, PAMOATE. We can administer mebendazole, or we can also administer albendazole. These are all antihemetic medications. This can be administered for patients who's having pinworm infestation, pinworm, or what we call enterobius vermicularis. For this medication, we get a single dose, and it might be repeated after 2 weeks. So we give a single dose, and the dose for this medication is measured according to the height of the patient. So when we did when we went out for affiliation back in Liberia while doing nursing, or if you live in those areas, you will see somebody who is the health officer of some focal person in the various towns. So they have a long stick that they have measurement with that stick. So the dose for this medication, they are administered according to the height, according to your height. That's how they were administering the medication back in Liberia when we were there. So it happened like in all those countries in West Africa. It happened there. So this can be measured, this dose can be administered based on the patient's height. Because at that time, there was no way to measure the patient's weight in those areas. Now, so we can administer them. Now, we want to make sure that these medications, they cannot be administered to any child less than 2 years. So this warm medication, this antihemetic, cannot be given to any child less than 2 years. It is contraindicated in anyone less than 2 years. You cannot take these antihemetic medications. Any question? So for the dehydration, we administer fluid. There are three kinds of fluid we want to administer there are three kinds of fluid, and those fluid are in your book. You want to look at the fluid and look at the indications and read them. We have what we call the isotonic fluid. We have the hypertonic fluid, and we have the hypotonic fluid. So you look in your book, you'll see which ones are the hyper, which ones are the hypo, which ones are the aso. When do we administer the hypo? When do we administer the hyper or the aso? They are all in your book. Now, if you're reading the English material and you have not known these things, that D5W is which fluid, or RL is what fluid, or what condition can we administer RL, meaning you've not read it for the English, because this is something that you should know before the English. These are important things. The sort of dehydration. When someone having a burn condition, what fluid can we administer? Somebody who has burned and having hypertension, what fluid can we administer? All these things are in the Saunders. They are in every book you pick up for message or pediatric books on all these conditions. They are there. They are listed in a very good way.
I want to please, sorry to take you back. I want to ask a question pertaining to the antihelmetics.
Yeah.
But now, supposing the question comes up from there now, do we see height and see weight? Are we still going to take height?
You take weight because those medications are measured according to weight, but because at the time there was no weight, there was no skill to weigh the patient on in those areas, so they were doing it with height, and the height is easier. So you can also use a patient height and assume their weight.